This is our reading group continuing our reading of Neo-Finalism. We're picking up from the beginning of chapter 9, which is page 90 of the book, of the translation. The title of this chapter is Absolute Surfaces and Absolute Domains of Survey. So this is sort of like a, you know, central concept that we've seen, you know, throughout what we've been reading so far. He's kind of been, I think, building up to this in the last couple chapters. So the first few chapters were primarily sort of like criticisms of other theories, other ways of understanding embryology and neuroscience primarily. And then now he's sort of setting out his own alternative, which you know, is centered on this concept of this absolute surface or absolute domain of survey. And so this is something that we're going to go into what exactly this means in the text here, but the general idea is that there's a certain point in explanation of any of these types of entities, like a biological entity, where you can't solely rely on a sort of step-by-step operation or one stage of a process sort of leading into the next, and so on. There has to be something, a kind of connection which goes beyond just this part interacts with the part next to it, and this sort of mechanical type of operation. So he's talked about, like, one of his sort of standard examples of this is the visual field, where, of course, the retina is made up of individual cells, the cones and rods, and then those cells are connected to regions of the visual cortex, so parts of the brain that respond to different types of stimulation appearing in a certain region of the visual field. So there are retinotopic maps within the visual cortex. There's like a, you can sort of look at this one region, and then within that region, there are sort of sub-regions that correspond to different portions of the retina. There are like multiple different retinotopic maps because there's different cells that respond either to, say, like motion in their region, or, you know, a vertical line in their region, or something, you know, different types of, very simple visual elements occurring in that region. And then our sort of like experience of a visual scene where we can discern different objects and, you know, the movement of those objects as one sort of coherent whole is somehow, put together out of all these different retinotopic maps and the connections between them. But what he's pointing out here is that the capacity to, say, recognize a vertical line has to involve some sort of kind of intrinsic connection. You can't just have, like, the fact that one cell is detecting a dark region and another cell is detecting a light region doesn't in itself produce detection of a contrast between those two regions. There has to be something that can sort of grasp both the dark and the light region at the same time and sort of recognize that contrast. So he points out that some other theories will try to explain this capacity in terms of like secondary connections between them. So you have the cell detecting the dark region and then the cell detecting the light region, and then you have like a connection between them that, or like a second order cell that sort of the two first order cells feed into, and it sort of detects a contrast. And there are sort of structures like that within the visual system. But he points out that you can't sort of explain everything in terms of like a preset collection of these sort of second, third, et cetera, order cells, because we can learn to recognize all kinds of different visual features. You can think of like the sort of most complicated ones are things like, you know, a baseball player, for example, can recognize what type of pitch is coming at them and respond accordingly all within, you know, a fraction of a second. And this, of course, requires learning. You have to, you know, practice doing that many times before you are able to recognize that pitch coming at you. And of course, there's no sort of like innate baseball pitch recognizing module within the human brain. It's something that there isn't like a pre-built, you know, circuit that connects all the cells in the right way to allow you to recognize a baseball pitch. It's something that given the, you know, contrast detection, movement detection, all these sort of basic sort of visual skills that we have, you can sort of learn to assemble them in the right way that you sort of turn yourself into a baseball pitch recognizing machine, or turn that region of your brain into a pitch recognizing machine. But that machine has to be sort of assembled. So this capacity that wasn't there has to be put together later on. And so it's precisely because we can, you know, put together these kinds of, you know, machines within ourselves that we can learn to detect new things. So you can't sort of explain that capacity in terms of something that already exists. You have to sort of explain how that capacity arises in the first place. And so this is sort of his general argument against sort of trying to explain away this, you know, in sort of intrinsic connection in terms of a pre-existing, you know, mechanical in the very broad sense, connection between different portions of, say, like the visual cortex. So even though there are, of course, connections between different regions of the visual cortex, you can't sort of explain everything in terms of like a preset collection of those connections. Like no matter how many like layers of connection you add, it's only going to be like a finite amount of those sort of capacities. And then, of course, we have an indefinite capacity to learn different visual features, although any one person can only learn a finite number. You know, you can't, or there are a few people who are, you know, both expert baseball pitch recognizers and, say, expert art critics that can, you know, detect, you know, a genuine Rembrandt and distinguish it from a fake, etc. You know, whatever sort of expertise you develop in visual recognition requires, you know, time and effort that you dedicate to one domain that, you know, you don't have available for other domains. But you know, the person who did become a baseball pitch recognizing expert could have, you know, under other circumstances, become a, you know, genuine Rembrandt recognizer. And so it's this, again, this sort of equipotentiality is another key concept that we've seen throughout what we've read so far. This, the fact that this region could have developed in a different way and developed the capacity to recognize something else shows that the capacity can't have been sort of can't have been due to some pre-built, you know, meta-level connection. Okay, so that's sort of like the big picture of what we've been looking at so far. So we can pick up from the beginning of chapter 9.
I can read. Chapter 9, quote-unquote, absolute surfaces and absolute domains of survey. Up until now, we have simply opposed the unitary domains of activity, cortical consciousness, embryonic and organic consciousness, individuality of non-statistical physics, to machines without equipotentiality, or to gestalt forms with only a pseudo-equipotentiality. Can we define the content of these domains and the relation of their properties to their nature more positively? To begin with, let us consider a simplified case. A physical surface, the surface of a table, for instance, can be defined partes extra partes. If the surface is checkered, figure 26, the various fragments of the marquetry will be external to one another. And there's a figure of a table with a checkerboard pattern on the surface. And then there's some kind of machine with a camera eye looking down at it. And next to it, an eyeball also looking down. Relative to any one among them, so the checkers, they're all somewhere else on the surface. To capture the entire surface, a camera has to be placed at some distance along a perpendicular dimension. By the same token, a living being that can be localized as a body must have its eye situated roughly like the camera to perceive the whole surface and its decorative pattern. If I look at a photograph of the table's surface, I will be forced once again to place my eyes at some distance from it. I have to be in a second dimension to photograph or perceive a line. I have to be in a third dimension to photograph or perceive a surface. We know, it is one of the commonplaces of popular books on mathematics, that one-dimensional beings in a one-dimensional world cannot see a line as a line, but only as a point. That infinitely flat beings living on a surface would believe they have sufficiently protected a treasure, T, by enclosing it within a circle that deters the indigenous thieves, V, V prime, V prime prime. But a thief evolving like us in a third dimension could touch T without touching the protective circle. figure 27. Figure 27 is just a plane with a circle, the letter T in it, so that's the treasure. And then these figures V, V prime, sort of moving towards T, but I guess unable to reach it because they're also two-dimensional. By analogy, it is easy to conclude that all the points of our solid bodies are simultaneously visible to an observer who exists in a fourth dimension. Solid bodies are quote-unquote open in the fourth dimension, as a circle is open in the third. A four-dimensional being could see and pierce our heart without touching our skin. In short, an observer always has to be situated in the n plus one dimension to see at once all the component parts of an n-dimensional being. And yet, this geometric law, which applies to the technique of perception, that is, to perception as a psychophysiological event, is invalid for visual sensation as a state of consciousness. Let us shift our attention from photographic observation and the organic mise-en-scène of perception to my visual sensation in itself. Like the table, or the photograph of the table, it contains multiple details, checkers which are also in a sense partes extra partes, each existing in a different location from theirs. This time, however, I, in quotes, do not need to be outside my sensation in a perpendicular dimension to consider each and all the details of this sensation, even when, instead of fixing my attention on the table, I quote-unquote inspect my sensation to register my astigmatism or my myopia. I do not have to place myself outside my sensation to know it. If I were to observe the cortex of a being in the process of looking at the table, I would have to be outside this cortex. But if I were experiencing my own sensation, I would not have to separate myself from it. This is a fortunate fact, because I would otherwise need a third eye to see what my first two eyes see, then a fourth to see what my third sees, and so on. Yeah, so this basic idea is pretty straightforward, unlike the one-dimensional being that needs a two-dimensional observer in order to be seen sort of in its entirety, the perceptual situation has this relation of observation to itself. So it would be like if the circle on the plane could sort of see itself as a circle without there needing to be a third-dimensional observer to see it as a two-dimensional shape. So there's this, in a couple of places, he calls it a non-dimensional observation that just sort of is part of, or just is, I guess, the perceptual situation itself. It stops this this regress that you would otherwise need. If you didn't have this kind of auto overflight, we would need to somehow sort of have a four-dimensional perception of our own perceptual situation in order to see it.
Yeah, I think he's probably thinking, part of this section is probably sort of a reference to the book Flatland that I think we might have talked about at some point, which is, of course, it's this sort of a novel, I guess, that is sort of depicting a world of two-dimensional beings that is, suddenly encounters, a three-dimensional being, and how sort of mysterious and hard to understand that is for them. And of course, the sort of moral of the story is, the point of writing the story is to sort of give us an understanding of what it would be like to encounter a four-dimensional being. Here in this example of the hiding a treasure from a two-dimensional being, you can just draw a circle around it. But of course, for us, we can just pick that treasure up without sort of breaking the circle. We can just go from above in a direction perpendicular to the surface and grab the treasure. And so he points out here that, of course, a being that could operate in a fourth spatial dimension could touch the heart of a human being without breaking its skin, for example, which would be very useful for performing surgery, but also rather creepy. But the point of sort of bringing up this adding of a dimension here is that this absolute surface is something that doesn't require this additional dimension to be present to itself, And yeah, the retina or the visual field is his sort of standard example of this, where if you are looking at the checkerboard, you have to have this extra dimension. You have to be at a certain distance from the checkerboard, say like perpendicular to the surface, to be able to see it as, you know, a board with these properties. And then, you know, when you're looking at the checkerboard, there's an image of it projected onto your retina. So this is a physical image. There's a, like, you can take a picture with a camera of that image on someone else's retina. But then there's also the inner perception of the checkerboard, which is not itself the result of looking at that image, you know, at it from a further distance. So there's no little eye within your head that looks at your retinal image and, you know, recognizes that it's a checkerboard. Because as he points out, if this were sort of the way that eyes worked, then, you know, that little eye would itself have to have an even smaller eye looking at its retinal image, and so on. At some point, there has to be this sort of immediate grasp of this patterned complexity that is the checkerboard. There has to be this absolute overview, which doesn't require a distance, an external observer that is at a certain remove from that surface. And so this is his sort of general sort of pattern, or his general schema of what an absolute surface or absolute overview consists in. It's this immediate sort of self-presentation of a structure. And here the term immediacy shouldn't sort of lead us to think that this is like some sort of like featureless sort of unity or identity. It's a unity that has structure. This patterned checkerboard doesn't all sort of merge into this one gray blob. We can grasp this structure in the visual field immediately without sort of combining everything all into one. So it's a kind of one and many at the same time. Okay, we can go on to the next bit. Organelles, could you read from page 92, I would be like? I'm not hearing you. I don't know if you're speaking. I can read this one while you're trying to get that figured out. Maybe just disconnect and try to reconnect. Yeah, okay, I'll read this one in the meantime. Okay. I would be like the man J.W. Dunn speaks of, who, wanting to create a complete painting of the universe, 1, first paints the landscape, 2, then realizes that he forgot himself and represents himself in the act of painting, 3, then realizes that he forgot to represent himself in the act of painting himself, and so forth. And he refers here to figure 28, which is, one of these, like the sort of Borax box type pictures, where we have exactly as described, the landscape, and then the canvas, which depicts the painter painting a landscape on the canvas, and so on. Because it is conscious knowledge and not observation knowledge, self-enjoyment essentially dispenses with infinite regress and a, quote, serial universe, unquote. Dunn believes that infinite regress is inevitable because he turns knowledge and consciousness into a kind of observation, or, as he says, quote, unquote, description. The observation of an experience must then be, once again, the observation and description of this experience as my own. But another observer has to observe and describe the second observer, who observes and describes the first, and so on. In fact, as Dunn says, quote, the mind which any science can describe can never be an adequate representation of the mind which can make that science, unquote. From this perfectly true thesis, Dunn draws a perfectly false conclusion. Quote, the process of correcting that inadequacy must follow the serial steps of an infinite regress, unquote. Obviously, the right solution is that the quote-unquote description, or quote-unquote observation of the mind, or the subjective domain, is a whole other matter than the subjectivity of the described or observed quote-unquote mind. Dunn's conception, though it amused many people, has not had great success in contemporary philosophy. But perhaps we have not carefully examined the consequences of the negation of infinite regress. Let us return to the surface of the seen table. Does not obey geometric laws. It is a surface seized in all of its details without a third dimension. It is a quote-unquote absolute surface, which is not relative to any point of view external to it, which knows itself without observing itself. If I were to place my eye on the table, I would see nothing, but I need not be, quote, at a distance, unquote, from the sensation to see it extended. In contrast, I cannot turn around the sensation to consider it from various angles. Quote-unquote I, my organism, can turn around the table to obtain different sensations, but quote-unquote I cannot turn around my sensation once I obtain it. Maybe I'll stop here. I think this last bit is a key point. It's something that I think in a different way or a different context, Husserl talks about in terms of what it is for something to be an object in the world that we experience and navigate in. This is precisely to be graspable by means of adumbrations, as he calls it, sort of a technical term. But like the idea here is that the table as an object, rather than just sort of the immediate sensory experience of the table. So the table as something that I can see and that other people can see and that I can interact with in various ways. This is for the table to be this kind of object in the world is precisely for it to be something that I can see from different perspectives. I can walk around the table and my sensations or my sensory experience will change in certain systematic ways as I walk around the table. I can touch it. I could lick it and taste it if I really wanted to. If I drop something on it, it will make a certain sound, etc. So there are all these sort of patterns in terms of the sensory experiences that I will get based on how I relate to this table or interact with this table. But the table itself is not identical to any of these sensory experiences. And precisely what makes those sensory experiences themselves not objects is that I can't get a different perspective on them or interact with them in different ways. So I can look at the table from different angles, but I can't look at my experience of the table from different angles. It's not another object that I would look at. And so this sort of distinction is what what Rie is getting at here as well. My experience of the table involves this kind of sensory experience, this sort of internal or this purely inner experience. But that experience itself is not like a second object, by means of which I experience the table, precisely because there is no other perspective on that that sensory experience. Organelles, do you want to try again to see if your mic is working now?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
Okay, great. All right. I think I'll read through A on this next little section.
Let's just see if anyone has any questions or comments or whatever on that last bit before we go on.
Okay.
Oh, maybe just one thing before we go on. This bit about the painting where you paint the landscape and then you paint yourself painting the landscape, etc. You can see that this is also connected to some of the sort of classic set theoretical paradoxes. So there's no set of all sets. Because if there were, it would have to be a member of itself, and then you can derive you can get the Russell paradox of the set of all sets that are not members of itself would have to be a subset of it leads to all sorts of paradoxes. But here this so the problem, and then there's also there's a similar sort of paradox if you assume that the set of truths or the collection of truths is a set, or the collection of known propositions is a set or whatever. If you have a collection of truths which would be a set, then for every truth there would be the truth that truth belongs to this set, and so no matter how big you sort of make that set, there will always be other, more sets than you can, or more truths than you can include in that set. So you end up with similar sorts of paradoxes of this sort of infinite regress. This is sort of an aside, but there's a lot of the sort of self-reference paradoxes and the sort of paradoxes of universality of some sort of self-contained domain of that would include also the sort of representation of that domain, whether it's knowledge or propositions or sets that contain sets, etc. These types of paradoxes are they all have a sort of family resemblance, I think, to this kind of infinite regress of the painting and then the painting of the painting, etc. Yeah, so okay, we can go on to the next bit, Organelles, if you would like to read from there.
The seen table is also a one-sided surface, like the Möbius surface, but in an entirely different sense. If I saw in my visual field a peripheral luminous stain moving forward, no mental procedure would allow me to see it moving backward, as an occultist who looks at my retina would observe it in his ophthalmoscope. As an oculist would observe through an ophthalmoscope. This fact is tied to the non-geometric nature of conscious survey. If the perceptible surface could be seen from both sides, it would not be sensation, but an object. As experience demonstrates, I can turn my attention or my, quote, mental prospection, unquote, to this or that detail of the sensation without moving my eyes. For instance, to this wider black square. I can swap the black or white squares in their roles as figure and ground, but this, quote-unquote, displacements of the internal observation do not obey the laws of physical displacement and observation and do not have the same effects. The sensation's multiple details are distinct from one another, and yet they are not truly other for one another because they constitute my unified sensation. They have a well-determined order. They have metrical relations, e.g., the squares appear equal. But this order of equality does not have a purely operational value, like the technique of the craftsman who inlaid the table. Order and multiple relations are immediately given in an absolute unity, which is nevertheless not a fusion or a confusion. This amounts to saying that my sensation is a form proper, a form and not a pattern, a structure, an assemblage of elements, or a gestalt form. Relative to this multiplicity of details in my sensation, quote-unquote, I, the indefinable, quote-unquote, I, appears as the unity, as a unity endowed with ubiquity. Here as well, sensation and subjectivity generally escape the ordinary laws of physics. It has been said that the core of the theory of special relativity amounts to the realization that one cannot be in two locations at once. In this sense, the absolute subjective expanse escapes the jurisdiction of the theory of relativity. Quote unquote, I am simultaneously in all locations in my visual field. There is no step-by-step propagation, no limit speed for such a domain. If I look at two clocks in a single glimpse, they will be one, despite their difference. There is no quote unquote absolute elsewhere in a subjective domain, because there is no absolute alterity between details. If I were to number the cases of the checkerboard, the squares at one end would be farther away from the squares at the opposite end than from the middle squares. And yet, this variable distance, which appears in the ordered figure of sensation, is not a true distance that would require physical means and energy to be overcome. The notion of absolute survey, of non-dimensional survey, is the key not only to the problem of consciousness, but also to the problem of life. It allows us to grasp the difference between primary consciousness and secondary consciousness, a problem we have already tackled. Since the question is a difficult one, let us reflect on concrete cases with the help of images. I'll do this first one. A. To begin with, let us schematize a man writing on a cluttered table as seen by an observer and, on the other hand, a protozoan, the example of a living being with a nervous system, in the process of skirting an obstacle by trial and error. And he refers here to figures 29 and 30. The observer sees the man turn his head and eyes, that is, his attention, toward the objects placed on the table. He can measure the distance between the man's eyes and his paper, as well as the distance between the protozoan and the obstacle. Similarly, he can follow the progression of optical stimuli and neural influxes from the seen objects to the retina, to the occipital area, to the motor cortical centers, and then to the medullary centers. So here this figure is just referring to as a removed observer. Figure 29, you just have a lateral view of a man sitting at his desk, this checkerboard desk, and he's writing, has his pen and pad. And so just you could physically measure all of these distances and include the measurements of the visual sensation within the neural network there within his head. So you could make all these these dimensional and quantifiable measurements. And in figure 30, you could likewise do the same for this protozoan. In figure 30, there's a rectangular box and a protozoan outside of it with a dashed line representing its movement. And it's sort of bouncing on and off of this obstacle in its way in a zigzag manner. So sensing the object, changing its movement, coming back, you know, and doing this a few repeated times. Just to me in this section, I think you guys have already set this all up perfectly, differentiating the immediate visual sensation from the external visual sensation, the physical act of visual sensation from the more, I guess you could say, equipotential visual act. And here he's also setting up that within this absolute visual sensation, there's no true space. That space is not a quantifiable domain within that sensation. There's no true alterity, no true separation between the objects within this subjective domain. So, yeah, I mean, just basically that, just setting up the difference between the objective domains and the subjective domains.
Yeah, and to make this even sort of, like Angus points out, that if you sort of picture, if you change this sort of image or thought experiment to, you know, even more distant objects, it sort of appears more vividly. So you can think of even, like, you know, looking at the night sky, assuming you're not in a city, you know, immersed in light pollution, you'll see like stars that in space, the actual stars as physical objects might be, you know, thousands or millions of light years away from each other. But your visual perception, the experience of those stars is not like, it doesn't take, time to sort of move from one star to the next. So these objects that are, you know, at these vast, almost incomprehensible distances from each other, can appear to you in this one sort of immediate grasp that doesn't require sort of moving from one to the other in a spatial sense. Oh, I should also note here this translation issue that's come up before with, so there's a sentence, if I were to number the cases of the checkerboard, it should be like the squares of a checkerboard, of course. It's just a, yeah, the French word is case, and so it's like, yeah, just a sort of, it's actually really a mistake. That's not really a possible translation of that word, but anyway, it should be squares of the checkerboard.
Yeah, one other just minor point, as I'm reading this, that I'm picking up is that he's highlighting is how even though within our immediate sensation, these physical geometric laws sort of collapse, it still feels like there's a physical distance within there.
I don't know if I would say exactly that it feels like there's a physical distance. What I think is definitely true is that the sort of non-distance doesn't mean that they're all, that everything is sort of collapsed into a single point or some indeterminate, you know, sort of blob, like I was mentioning at the beginning. So like when you look at, like, you know, the constellation an arrangement of stars is a perfect example of this, because the stars, of course, they have this sort of almost point-like luminance. If you're very careful, like very careful astronomical observation, you can sort of detect the different size of the, or different apparent size of the stars to us, which of course doesn't necessarily correspond to the actual size of the stars as objects. The star, you can see multiple stars at the same time without all of the stars sort of collapsing into one point. So your visual experience is not of, you know, just a brightness in some vague, you know, non-localizable sense, but rather of an arrangement of stars, Orion's belt or whatever it is, the Big Dipper. You're grasping not just, you know, brightness against a dark background, but bright spots arranged in a certain shape against a dark background. So they aren't sort of geometrically distant from each other, of course, because you're grasping them in this sort of immediate unity that doesn't correspond in any straightforward way with the actual distance of those objects from each other, but at the same time, there's a kind of, I don't know, quasi-distance between the stars that you are perceiving, in the sense that they are not perceived as all in the same space or in the same place, and you can say that one star is above another or you know, to the left of another, etc.
It's a good point that he makes, that the objects in the visual field don't really stand, in a sense, they don't really stand in a metrical relationship to one another. Like, of course, I could measure, you know, the distance between two cups on the table, but that objective distance isn't really the distance, you know, the sort of the spatial relation that they have, you know, as objects in the perceptual field. I'm not really sure how you would go about trying to measure that second spatial relation.
Yeah, I know that you can, like, use sort of the angular distance as a sort of measure of yeah, visual distance, I guess. So I think, if I remember correctly, if you, like, sort of stick your thumb out and extend your arm and put the, you know, put your arm in front of you, then your thumb, you know, as you are, like, the thumb that you're seeing covers approximately 1 degree of the visual field, if I remember correctly. And you can, you know, I think, you know, sort of instrumental astronomy, so astronomy before, you know, telescopes and these types of instruments, did use sort of measurements in terms of degrees, although it's slightly different, because of course you're as an astronomer, you're measuring degrees in terms of the sky as a sort of current sphere around you, or it's actually not even quite spherical, because it's like, anyway, it's more complicated than just a sphere, but anyway, as a sort of dome above you, which doesn't correspond to any physical object, and there's no, you know, physical dome on which the stars are arrayed, but you as a person can move around and, you know, turn from one side of the sky to the other within that apparent dome, so it doesn't exactly correspond to the visual field, which of course you can't move around inside your own visual field, but it's hard to express exactly what that sort of apparent dome consists in, because it's not a physical object, of course. There's no actual dome there, physically speaking, but it's also not a visual field, because you as a person, you know, as a living being with a body that, you know, you can turn around and see different portions of it. So that astronomy is maybe, like, that form of astronomy is like a little bit closer to sort of measuring the distance between, say, stars within that sort of apparent dome space. So you can say that, you know, this star is so many degrees and X minutes, you know, south of this other one or whatever. So I guess you could, if you could do like a sort of fixed observation point astronomy, like if you had, you know, the person is, you know, tied to the chair like in Plato's cave, except now the cave is now, you know, the dome of the stars. And then you can't move your head, and you're just sort of looking in one direction, and then you could sort of measure the distance between the stars in that fixed visual field.
Yeah, it kind of makes me think of like figure drawing, and how you have to sort of get used to seeing the object that you're drawing in a different way, and not see it as you sort of think it should look, because that often, you know, results in a kind of caricature drawing. Sounds kind of strange to say, but the nose that you're looking at often doesn't look like what you think a nose should look like, even though you can kind of recognize it as a nose. Maybe it's that kind of way of seeing is in a way closer to that degree-based kind of seeing the field, I guess, as opposed to seeing the objectivity of what's in the
field. Yeah, and I know that, like, I think that in sort of like early perspective drawing, so I guess like 16th century, they would sometimes use like a sort of grid that, like, the artist would put a sort of a mesh or something over, like, a very coarse mesh over the canvas, and sort of like like you draw just one sort of square, or you draw what you see through this one square. You put a sort of mesh between you and whatever you're drawing, and then you have the canvas sort of divided up into a grid, and then so you just draw like one little square of the you know what you're seeing through this mesh, and then you move on to the next one, etc. And of course, this is very different than our sort of normal way of perceiving. And you can think of like the sort of ancient Egyptian human figure drawings is sort of like a classic example of this kind of drawing the object you see and not the visual perception of what you're seeing, because you have like these human figures where there's like two legs, and then the torso is facing outwards, or facing is sort of parallel to the surface of the that is being drawn on, so you can see the torso from the front and the two arms, even though the legs are, you can see both legs that are perpendicular to the surface. And of course, so this is like sort of depicting the human body as having two arms and two legs, even though it would be a very strange like you have to sort of twist your body to actually make that posture, you know, visible for someone, you know, looking at you from the side. So yeah, this is a kind of drawing, you know, of what a human body consists of rather than how a human body looks from a particular angle. And you see this also with, you know, when kids draw, they often will, you know, draw, you know, what the object consists of rather than, it's quite difficult to actually learn how to draw the perspectival drawing where you're sort of depicting an angle of vision on a certain scene or a certain object in the perspectival way that all the angles are sort of consistent with each other rather than, you know, drawing what is there, what, you know, the drawing what the object consists of. So that's I guess that perspectival drawing, like learning to see in perspective, is almost like what Rui is talking about, where you would sort of like look at your visual field from outside. It's as if your eye is sort of like zooming back and looking at itself in a strange way. So that sort of, I think, illustrates why this would be something difficult to learn how to do, because it's, you know, you have to sort of in imagination sort of like zoom your eye backwards and have it look at its own visual perception. Yeah, on that sort of grid drawing trick, I think if I remember correctly, there's a Dürer like woodcut where he's like depicting himself doing this, if I remember correctly. I'd have to check afterwards, but yeah, that would be almost an example of the landscape painting guy that Rui mentions earlier. So the point here is that this is not our normal way of perceiving the world. And of course, when you look at a drawing or a painting that's in perspective, so you are, you know, outside the surface, and you can only see the painting because your eye is at a distance from it. If you stick your eye on the canvas, you won't see anything. But again, you're not, you know, looking at your own visual field from a distance in perspective in the same way. So yeah, that perspective requires that distance, but your own visual field is not something that you look at under a perspectival, you know, sort of angle of view.
I can read from B.
Yeah, go ahead.
B, let us now suppose that I myself am the seated man. Here's what my visual field affords me. Figure 31. Oh yeah, so figure 29 is just a drawing of a man sitting at a table. Figure 30 is an amoeba kind of navigating around an object. And then 31 is it's a drawing of the visual field of the man sitting at the table. You can see like the circles of his glasses, the periphery. This visual field immediately presents both my body of my head, only the vague circle of my glasses, and the more vague images of my nose and lips are visible. And the objects I observe, namely my table, the books that clutter it, and the paper on which I'm writing. A perceptible distance immediately appears between my seen body and the seen table, a distance that seems to correspond to the distance between my real body and the real table that the observer is measuring. Biology teaches us that this field of sensory consciousness is localized in my occipital cortex. It is probably the very reality of my area striata, or of a certain level of this area. But at any rate, what is certain is that all the details of the sensory image have to be given immediately in an absolute unity, because there is no third retina or second striatal area that can see this visual field from the outside as the observer sees them in the process of writing. The quote-unquote I, or the conscious unity, whatever it may be, has the acute impression of surveying this field of consciousness as though it observed it from the outside. I can hardly resist the temptation to imagine myself, to imagine the quote-unquote I, above the apparent circle of my glasses, by identifying this quote-unquote I unity with a kind of center of the invisible head that my sensation allows me to presuppose. And yet it is clear that the quote-unquote I, the unity of consciousness, is not at a distance in a perpendicular dimension from the totality of the visual field in the same way that my eyes and my head are at a distance from the paper on which my hand is writing. The image of my glasses and the vague shadow of my nose and my eyebrows form part of my visual field. Thus the biologist who observes me from the outside can localize all these perceptible forms, like all the images of my body in my area striata, where, it is worth repeating, there is no third eye. My visual field necessarily sees itself through a quote-unquote absolute, or quote, non-dimensional survey. It surveys itself without positioning itself at a distance and in a perpendicular dimension. It is therefore a gross error to imagine the visual field in the occipital area as a kind of photograph, or as those cinematographic montages in which a three-dimensional scene suddenly becomes an album page that begins to turn before us on the screen, three-dimensional scene. Between the quote-unquote eye unity and the visual field, there is only a purely symbolic quote-unquote distance. Figure 32. Figure 32 is just sort of the image of figure 31 as a flat plane with an eye labeled mythical third eye looking. Assuming we accept the natural hypothesis that the visual field has some connection to the occipital area, the visual sensation proves then that at least a certain part of the organism is capable of direct self-consciousness. It sees itself through absolute survey without any observer in a perpendicular dimension. Because the occipital area, which is modulated by optical stimuli, ultimately has to see itself, to enjoy itself, why couldn't the protozoan, quote-unquote, see itself directly just as much as our cortical tissue? The protozoan has neither eyes nor a mirror, but neither does our cortex have an eye or a mirror to see what the eyes have already brought it. Seeing itself, the protozoan, or its quote-unquote unity in absolute survey, will not see external forms in this field of self-enjoyment. It will not see, for instance, the form of the obstacle it is trying to skirt. It has no sensory organs that would permit the modulation of a part of its organism according to the pattern of external objects. Its field of consciousness will only be its own organic form, which is in principle the entire universe for it. This surveyed organic form could be as distinct as our visual field and could present all the structural details of the cytoplasmic architecture as clearly as our visual sensation presents all the details of the checkered and cluttered table we are looking at. This organic form or primary consciousness is not vague or psychoid. It has no reason to be so. It can never even be, quote, myopic for itself, like a visual sensation in the secondary consciousness, because it is not our occipital cortex that is my eyes. I'll stop there. There are a couple of points in this section that are very interesting to me, one of which is this suggestion that the occipital lobe, or the visual processing system in the nervous system, at least as I'm reading him here, this part of the nervous system sort of just is this absolute survey of the visual scene, that if studied by another person who is a biologist or a neuroscientist, it just looks like, physical brain math. Not that it isn't that objectively and from a third person perspective, but primarily it is this this sort of for itself auto overflight of the synthesis of, the light that has hit and been processed by the retina and the early visual processing system. And then it does seem like a natural enough suggestion to say that if this is true of the visual processing system and the human nervous system, why would that only be the case, the human nervous system? or, you know, maybe this is a bit more of a stretch, but, you know, why wouldn't it also be the case for a living being that doesn't have a nervous system at all? I guess the strength of that argument is that, you know, at some point it has to be the case that, you know, the world appears to something. There's this for itselfness of a form taking, and it does seem a bit arbitrary to limit that to nervous systems themselves, especially because, as Rouillet points out, you know, we don't start out as a nervous system. The nervous system has to be constructed by the embryo. It seems even though it seems strange, I guess, to suggest that the amoeba experiences the world, it might be less convincing to suggest that, you know, there's just sort of nothing at all in terms of experience, and then suddenly, out of nothing, there's this sort of for itselfness only as soon as there's a nervous system.
Yeah, I think this is kind of where it starts to go here, but just real briefly, it feels like he's setting up this difference between the eye sensation, the quote unquote eye sensation, and the visual sensation itself. So separating these two kind of conscious experiences, I suppose, or domains.
Yeah, this passage is a little bit tricky to talk about in English because of the homophony between the I personal pronoun and I as in the organ in your face that is involved in visual perception. In French, you don't have that problem, of course. He gives this, I think that the two figures here, like, this is almost like a sort of encapsulation of like his whole like argument in this book, is that, so you have this figure 31 is, of course, the little depiction of, you know, the view of the man looking at the desk. So he sees, you know, the sort of rim of the glasses outside, you know, at the edges of the visual field, and looking down at the desk, and he can see his arm and torso and legs and so on. Although I think the perspective here is a little bit distorted in terms of you know, what is actually visible in the scene and so, and the sizes and so on. And then figure 32 is like, there should be like a big you know, X through this picture, because this is, you know, his this is what he's arguing against, is the idea that you are sort of looking at your visual field from outside. And of course, when you look at the page, when you look at 31, figure 31 on the page, that's exactly what you're doing, is that your eye is perpendicular to the either the paper page or the computer screen or whatever that you're looking at a distance from it, and looking at it from outside. And that's exactly what is depicted in figure 32. But of course, that is not what the actual, you know, experience of sitting at your desk looking at something is like. You're not sort of seeing your visual field from a distance. And again, so if you have that mythical third eye, like in figure 32, you're also looking at from a distance. So your eye is, you know, at a perpendicular distance to the drawing in figure 32. And then, so if that were itself, you know, something that you had to look at, you would have another fourth eye, et cetera, et cetera. So again, these two pictures are almost like his whole sort of, yeah, if you were to like encapsulate this book in one page, that I think this page of these two figures would be it. But yeah, then he points out that, you know, of course, this doesn't just apply to, you know, organisms like us and other, you know, vertebrates that have these complicated eyes and this complicated nervous system that is, you know, taking in all this information that is captured by the eyes, etc. You can even go to something as simple as an amoeba. It is still, you know, capable of detecting some sort of difference. So, like, there are certain organisms, single-celled organisms that are that, you know, follow a gradient of sugar, for example. They go upstream, you know, towards higher concentration of sugar. So to be able to do that, they have to, of course, be able to recognize a distinction of, you know, higher sugar concentration in one direction and lower in another direction. Or maybe they integrate over time, for example, that, like, they can compare, you know, sugar concentration at moment A, and then as they move, they compare that with sugar concentration at moment B. And if it's getting greater, they keep going in the same direction. If it is not getting greater, then they you know, select a different direction and move in a different direction. In any case, there has to be some sort of integration either of two different spatial directions at the same time or of two different times or something. There has to be some sort of integration of these separate points or elements or whatever to be able to compare them and identify which one has the higher sugar gradient, the higher sugar concentration. So even this like extremely simple behavior of, you know, swimming up the sugar gradient, it requires some kind of integration. And of course, the amoeba or the whatever, you know, bacteria, whatever, doesn't have a nervous system, that doesn't have like a sort of mechanical apparatus already set up to perform that integration. So yeah, it's this sort of absolute overview is something that we should not limit to organisms that have a complicated nervous system, though obviously, you know, our capacity to integrate many details into a, you know, a single visual field is much more elaborate than the capacity that an amoeba or whatever has to you know, integrate higher and lower moments of sugar concentration, for example.
Yeah, I remember talking about tropism and taxism, I think, in the vital individuation section of Simondon's ILNFI. And yeah, it's hard to imagine what it might, you know, be like, I guess, to perceive sugar gradient as a bacterium or, you know, similar organism. But I just think it's a very cool idea that all of these kind of modalities of form taking have this kind of auto overflight character. So it would kind of apply to, in some sense, to everything Simondon talks about.
Yeah, and yeah, that melodic, like the sort of use of this term melodic in this sense is something that Merleau-Ponty does a lot in the structure of behavior that we read as well. Yeah, so this is like a point of convergence of all three, that they're all sort of getting at a similar idea from different sides, this idea of this sort of the intrinsic structure that is not put together out of self-contained parts. And so like melody, of course, is a sort of absolute overview in time that, like, you know, you're not just grasping, there's not just a sensation of note A and a sensation of note B that you know, somehow you know, get connected to each other afterwards. Of course, you do actually have to perceive, you know, first one note, then the next. They don't sort of like blur together. But at the same time, you can only perceive an interval and then a melody if you are somehow grasping the two notes together without sort of blurring them together. Yeah, so you're grasping them as distinct, but also with this sort of connection, rather than having two sort of self-contained note perceiving sensations. And so, yeah, it's the same, like a lot of these examples that Rie gives here could have also been presented in terms of, you know, hearing a melody, you know, so not a spatial or quasi-spatial absolute overview, like looking at the checkerboard, but a temporal absolute overview, like hearing a melody.
Yeah, my background here isn't strong, but this reminds me of Bergson as well, what I do know of Bergson.
Yeah, so I think maybe the one of the key points here, and all three of these people, of course, were you know, very familiar with Bergson's work and you know, were sort of writing in relation to his work as well. But one of the key connections here is the sort of non-metric or at least pseudo-metric nature of this absolute overview domain. So like we were talking about in relation to space, of course, you can't, you know, measure the distance of two objects from each other in the visual fields by, you know, putting a ruler between them, and like you can measure how far away from each other they are in physical space using a ruler, but that doesn't tell you how far away from each other they are in visual space. And likewise, you know, the melody perception is not entirely reducible to clock time, you know, that you would measure by like by the beat of a pendulum, for example. And you know, this is apparent when you, like, if you're a musician, of course, you want to practice using a metronome, precisely because your sort of like inner perception of rhythm is not sort of fixed in relation to clock time. So you might start playing and think you're keeping the same tempo, but you are, you know, sort of gradually speeding up or slowing down over the course of playing a piece of music, whatever it is. And so, yeah, practicing with a metronome is sort of like synchronizing your, you know, inner time experience of the melody or the, you know, the pattern of notes that you're playing with clock time, so that you sort of develop the habit of playing, as synchronized as possible to clock time. So if you're just listening to a melody or you're just playing without a metronome, you're still, of course, proceeding in a kind of duration. The first note of the melody and the last note are distinct from each other, but it's not something that you can measure in terms of, you know, seconds or, you know, beats of a metronome, at least not directly.
Yeah, the examples that you gave of sort of phenomenological time, not perfectly converging clock time, of course, made me think of Heidegger and his examples of like a town being like half a pipe smoke away or something like that. I don't think Rouillet is as interested in the, I guess, kind of pragmatic or practical dimensions of auto overflight, whereas Heidegger obviously strongly emphasizes, kind of practical form taking involved in, you know, like using a similar non-theoretical ideas.
Yeah. So yeah, the sort of half a pipe's worth or half a pipe's distance away, sort of, this is of course a very sort of coarse measurement. It's still a measurement of some kind. You're still, you know, you're using the pipe to measure time and then using time to measure distance. But it is still a measurement of some kind. It's just that it's not, you know, synchronized with, say, like the orbit of the Earth around the Sun in the way that clock time is. So I think that's still different in a sense from the kind of inner time that, say, like the perception of a melody would be. But maybe like a closer connection, like in Heidegger, is from his, I think it's 1929 lecture course, Fundamental Concepts of Metaphysics, where he talks about boredom. Of course, if you're like, he talks about, you know, you're waiting at the train station, you know, you look at the schedule, I've got like 37 minutes till my train arrives, and you're just sort of like standing there waiting, and, you know, you look at the clock and you wait a little bit more, and then you look and you see, oh, it's only been, you know, 4 minutes, and it feels like you've been there forever. So that, like, you know, 4 minutes of just standing there waiting feels very different than, you know, a 4 minute interval where, you know, something, I don't know, you're watching a movie that you're like engrossed in or something. And you know, of course, we have all these, you know, sort of sayings, you know, time flies when you're having fun, et cetera. Like, yeah, we sort of experience a certain interval of clock time in a very different way, depending on what is happening or what we're doing within that interval. So that inner experience of boredom, where time just seems to drag on, is sort of the sort of connection of one moment to the next is experienced differently in this case than when you're, you know, engrossed in a task and, you know, find, you know, oh, I just spent 2 hours doing this without even, you know, noticing it.
It's like you might go to like maybe some jazz performances or something where you have several musicians at the top of their game, and they might be like, you might actually have two different rhythms, you know, being played, kind of setting up like some kind of tension, you know, and then they might resolve that suddenly and then pull it back apart or something. Or you can kind of see like maybe one instrument starts to kind of shift the rhythm a little bit and kind of move this, and everybody kind of comes along with it or something. So just seeing these different forms, or I mean, actually the auditory experience of seeing form take shape, I suppose.
Yeah, there's a whole sort of like domain of sort of like musical exploration of like polyrhythms, where yeah, you're playing a certain like 3/2 rhythm or something like that, and it's you can sort of do this kind of gestalt switch when you're listening to this type of rhythm. You can either experience the triplet pattern as like primary, and then the multiples of two as a kind of like in between the triplets, or vice versa. You can sort of like switch between the two depending on, you know, how exactly the rhythm is being played. So it's similar to seeing the cube either from above or from below, like just sort of swapping perspectives on it. It also reminds me of this like anecdote about James Jamerson, who was the bass player for the Motown sort of house band for many years. He would apparently, when they were doing like rehearsals, he would sometimes like, he would be playing along, you know, at one, you know, tempo with everyone else, and then he would start tapping his foot at a different tempo, like just to mess everyone up, as sort of like a joke. So he could apparently, keep one tempo going with his, you know, hands, and then a different one with his foot, and everyone else was like completely messed up by this. There's several of Steve Reich's compositions involve these sort of phase. There's a piano phase and a violin phase, and then there's also the "It's Gonna Rain," which is like a tape recording thing. But they all involve like taking two sort of copies of the same pattern, either like an audio clip or a melodic pattern, and then having one copy slow down or speed up relative to the other, and just sort of cycling through until they all come back to until both copies come back to alignment with each other. You can find there's a clip on YouTube of someone playing piano phase, like both parts, on two different pianos, which is kind of incomprehensible to me that like you can do that. So this kind of like synchronization stuff there's lots of things we could go into about like synchronization.
So there's also the famous John Zorn piece "Cobra," where it's just all the musicians just messing with each other across the stage at John Zorn's direction. Yeah, a lot of great stuff like that.
And then also, this is all a little bit of a tangent here, but you can also use the expectation of a uniform time to sort of defeat that expectation, I guess. Like, so you have music where the time is sort of deliberately not uniform, where you delay the snare, for example, you can think of like Flying Lotus and things like that, where the time is not uniform, and like your sort of expectation of a uniform time that is not fulfilled leads to this sort of like tension in the music, even though from a purely audio analysis perspective, there's nothing different, or there's nothing sort of intrinsically different between the snare being at one moment and being, you know, 10 milliseconds later or whatever. It's just the waveform is slightly different, but from a listening perspective, the snare being slightly delayed produces a kind of tension. So I think we can go on to the next bit. Where did we stop? Are we at item? No, we already read item C. Where exactly did we stop?
Are we at the first full paragraph on page 98? I believe, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. I can read this one. So we're at "In other words." Okay. "In other words, there is at bottom only a single mode of consciousness, primary consciousness, form in itself of every organism and at one with life. The secondary sensory consciousness is the primary consciousness of cerebral areas. Because the cortex is modulated by external stimuli, sensory consciousness gives us the form of external objects. But this particular content does not represent an essential trait of consciousness and life. There's no reason to deny subjectivity, primary consciousness, self-survey, and the self-enjoyment of their own form to our non-cortical and even non-neural cells, or to our own organism in general. The quote-unquote I does not participate in this self-enjoyment because it is specialized in sensory consciousness. It is not surprising that the quote-unquote I of secondary consciousness should be irremediably cut off from primary consciousness, that quote-unquote I should have no direct primary consciousness of my organism. This disconnection represents a normal phenomenon of quote-unquote distribution, like the quote-unquote distributions that fragment the areas of development in the course of embryogenesis and quote-unquote determine them by specializing them. Synesthesia, as we have seen, Sorry, that's it should probably be kinesthesia, I think, is the normal spelling of that word. So kinesthesia, as we have seen, has nothing to do with primary consciousness. It is a secondary consciousness in the same way as visual consciousness. Both presuppose a healthy cortical area, a parietal area. Likewise, the instinctive drives and the sensations of organic need, which emerge in the secondary consciousness, cannot give the quote-unquote I consciousness any intuition of the essence of primary consciousness. To believe that they do is an inexhaustible source of philosophical error, for by imagining organic consciousness on the model of the drives through which it communicates with the secondary consciousness, we attribute to it, for no good reason, the vague and confused character that belongs uniquely to these messengers. Contrary to an ingrained prejudice, consciousness, or the ex-unity of non-dimensional survey, is not essentially perceptive or cognitive of spatial-temporal structures. It is essentially active and dynamic. It organizes spatial-temporal, organic or sensory, structures that are given to it in its field of survey. Consciousness cognizes only ideas, forms, themes, or transspatial types, at which it aims beyond the field of survey and according to which, as ideals or norms, it organizes or improves the organization of structures, forms in the field. This is the most delicate point of our difficult question. We should vehemently deny the existence of a geometric dimension that provides a point of observation external to the sensory field. But we should affirm no less vehemently the existence of a sort of quote-unquote metaphysical transversal to the entire field, whose two quote-unquote extremities are the quote-unquote I, or the X of organic individuality on one hand, and the guiding idea of organization on the other. For the primary consciousness, for example, the protozoans, the guiding ideal is the organic type. For the secondary consciousness of an animal with a nervous system and sensory organs, the guiding ideal is both the organic type and an Umwelt immediately connected to this type, according to which the bee, for instance, only sees in the external forms captured by its sensory organs, the flowers as reserves of nourishment, the hive as refuge, and so on, and searches for and maintains them in this state. For the human secondary consciousness, the guiding ideal is the world of essences and values, detached from the human organic type. But in these three cases, consciousness is not an inert domain that is simply unified by the absolute survey. Consciousness is organizing. The protozoan strives to maintain its organic type despite the physical chemical phenomena that tend to alter it. The bee shapes the world according to the instinctive nosia that characterize its specific Umwelt. Quote unquote, I strive, for example, figure 33, I'll come back to that in a second. I strive, for example, to tidy up my scene table by referring to an ideal of order, or I strive to maintain my tools in good condition, or more generally, I strive to realize my ideal norms by incarnating them in the beings and objects that surround me. So figure 33 is so on the left we have the amoeba, and then we have these lines extending above and below the amoeba. So we have the type, the line above is labeled type, and the line below is labeled X. So this is this sort of movement or quasi-movement goes from this ideal type of the, you know, the living being down to the amoeba, and then the X is the sort of unity of the living being amoeba. And then on the right side, we have a similar diagram to above, to the one above, I think it was 31, that shows the view of the man looking at his desk. But now we have this line above that is labeled ideal of order. There's some discussion in the chat here about how it's kind of funny that his like example of these ideals, these sort of like eternal ideas are having a tidy desk, probably not exactly what Plato had in mind when he brought up the idea of these eternal forms. I think so this is maybe connected to some of the discussion in the cybernetics book, where we talked about the Maxwell's demon type of arguments and the notion of entropy and order, that as a living being or as an entity that is sort of realizing ideals, I can introduce order into an environment. Of course, I do so by in order for me to say tidy my desk, I have to move my muscles, which requires all sorts of chemical reactions to occur, which are actually increasing entropy. So the total disorder in the whole system, which includes, myself, all the chemicals that make up my muscles and nervous system and so on, and, the books on the table and, paper or whatever junk is on my desk, that whole system, the entropy as a whole is still increasing. The sort of total amount of disorder is increasing, but at the same time, the arrangement of objects on my desk is becoming more ordered as a result of that operation. So I can sort of use or modulate that flow of entropy, that increase in disorder, in such a way as to produce order in a sort of localized domain. And this is sort of like what life consists in general. And of course, this is only possible because I'm also over time taking in food, which has these chemical bonds that are that have a lower degree of entropy. I can consume food and break down the chemical bonds within it to release energy and perform work. So it's only because there is this flow of substances that I can use as sort of fuel for that entropy releasing machine that I can locally increase order by arranging the junk on my desk. So the point here is that this absolute overview property, although it is obviously extremely important, is not a sort of passive contemplation. So the point of the absolute overview is not just to look at the checkerboard and recognize it as a checkerboard or whatever. It involves the sort of incarnation of these values that a human life is. The checkerboard is obviously not something that in general is that important in terms of values. Although if you are, say, like a chess player, that same board might be very important to you. But our sort of perceptual grasp of the world is part of our capacity to act in the world in some way, which involves making changes in the world that get us closer to realizing those ideals in some sense, or at least of keeping ourselves in existence so that we can achieve those ideals, etc. So this sort of absolute overview quality is a sort of capacity is something that that only exists insofar as it is realizing an ideal. It's not just we're not sort of contemplating checkerboards for the sake of contemplation. We have this sort of section break thing where there's like a gap between the paragraphs here, and we're approaching the end of our time allotment, so I'm going to suggest that we end here for today and then pick up from the next section or whatever that break is meant to depict, the next bit in the chapter next time. So thanks everyone for coming out, and hope to see you next time.
Thanks, see you next week. Everyone.